So this is possibly one of the best inventions ever to happen to beer, which is a lid that isn't just like a little pull tab with the hole, but when they pull off, it's like that much pulls off. And you've actually got a proper mouth to pour a beer through. So this is bespoke sprocket. So Canberra beer. And it makes it so much easier to pour. Look at that. Isn't that a great idea? Let's just the little simple things. If I could, I would 3D print that, but that's going to be another story about 3D printing. It's going to be a lot of stories about things today. 3D printing, I'm going to save it a little bit later because I do have other related things, including data breach stuff, I'm talking about first. Niall's joined. G'day, mate. Welcome. Niall from Norway, one of my best mates. I haven't seen you for a long time. But positive news is it might be sooner rather than later. I'm sure everyone around the world is watching vaccine stuff. We're quite a way behind in Australia vaccine-wise because we basically have almost no COVID here. It's pretty much just people that come in from overseas and end up in hotel quarantine. But we're hearing a lot of positive things from Qantas, as I'm sure you're hearing from many other airlines around the world, that we will be traveling overseas again September, October sort of time frame. So I'm tentatively hoping for like a January Norway trip, as well as other parts of Europe. We'll see. So maybe then, mate. Maybe some steaks and beers then. Okay, so things today. Now, I mentioned a book thing. Now, last week I spoke a little bit about a book, and this week I want to throw some questions out there because I'm in this phase of trying to elicit more information from people as I write this thing. And I mentioned that this was a book that was – it was an idea that was put to me by a friend. It's a friend Noel knows, but someone I'll talk about more in subsequent updates when they're ready to get a bit more involved. And it's very much a collection of different things that I have written since I started writing the blog back in 2009, yeah, I remember now. Back in 2009, and it's a bunch of blog posts, and you know, like they're out there on troyhunt.com anyway, so nothing new there. But this book ties them all together and gives a lot more context into why I wrote the thing, because there's often very, very different reasons behind it, and also some of the things that happened afterwards as well. Now, there was often a lot that I couldn't say in the blog posts, either because they're related to everything from work to relationships to ongoing investigations, data breach style. And then there are lots of things that happened afterwards that sort of didn't make it into the blog post but happened as a result of the blog post. And I'll sort of give you a good example. And the question I want to put out to people is like, what do you want to know? So this very much tracks not just a lot of the things I've written but sort of the way my career went and the way it went from being in a very kind of normal office-based job through to a life of like jet skis and beaches, and it used to be airplanes as well, but you know what happened with that. So if you have questions or things that you would really like to know about the things I've done over the last decade and a bit, or questions about how my career became what it is today or my life became what it is today, drop them in the YouTube comments. If you're watching this later on, drop them in the comments on my blog post because I really want to know what it is that other people want to see. But I'll give you a good example. So there's a blog post I wrote about how I optimized my life to make my job redundant. Now, this was in 2015, just after I had a redundancy from Pfizer. So I worked for Pfizer for, what was it, 14? Yeah, 14 years. It became a blur. And when I was there, so obviously I started writing my blog whilst I was at the company, I never mentioned the company, never ever in a blog post anywhere because I was worried about how it would be received. So if I mention them, would they not want the association? And especially when I'm talking about hacker stuff and data breaches and this sort of thing, they're a conservative, traditional organization. Of course, Pfizer is very popular these days because they are, I think, probably the biggest maker of the Pfizer vaccine. I needed a bloody Pfizer vaccine after 14 years of the COVID vaccine. So good on them for that. Before that, they were well known for making Viagra, among other things. But anyway, so I'm at Pfizer and I get the redundancy, and the very first time I ever mention their name is in that blog post, how I optimized my life to make my job redundant. And it was the very first time, and I posted it the day I left the organization. Now, what I didn't say in the blog post is that I had not yet been paid my redundancy money. So they had a very good redundancy provision. And I got paid the equivalent of almost a couple of years' worth of work to leave the organization. And I didn't want to jeopardize that money. So when I wrote the blog post, it was very like name, rank, and serial number. I hope to go on and do these other things. And I didn't talk about the things that really drove me out of the place. And there's a story here, and this is really timely that you're here, Niall, because you're actually in this bit that I've written in the book, but you weren't in the original blog post. So I had grown absolutely sick and tired of my job. And the thing that was the final straw for me that made me almost walk out, and fortunately I didn't, because I wouldn't have got the redundancy payout if I walked out. But I got a new boss in the start of 2014. And when I got this new boss, I said to him, look, I'm going to do my first international talk. I'm going to Codemania in New Zealand. And this was about April 2014. It's all cleared with the previous boss. All good. That's what I'm going to do. And the new boss, shortly after, so I had to report to a guy in the Philippines, a guy called Gerard. I'm putting names in this. I assume it's going to be fine. He's in the Philippines. What's he going to do? And he said shortly after I started reporting to him, he said, well, I would really like you to go to Manila for a meeting. It sounds so weird now. Like, we used to fly around the world for a meeting. Really want you to go to a meeting. And it's going to clash with when you are going to be doing not just your first international talk, but a closing keynote right after Scott Hanselman as well, which all of that to me was a really, really big deal. And I sort of went to him, well, I can't, because I'm doing the thing that we agreed on. And then he replied and he said, well, I'd really like you to come to the meeting in the Philippines. And I said, well, it's really still the same thing. I really can't. And not only am I going to go and do the talk, but I'm going to have a couple of days off after that and see some sites around Auckland in New Zealand. And then he came back and he gave me this line, and I can't believe he put it in writing, which was stupid. But he literally said, the only priority is the company. Like, this was his position. It's like, you can't go to New Zealand and do the talk you committed to, and people buying tickets in part based on your appearance at the show, because the only priority is the company. Now, I suspect that just due to the culture in the Philippines, and it is very hierarchical and there's a lot of respect. And I'll give you an example of this. Like, I would go to Manila and I would wander around the offices, and people who deemed themselves to not be at as high a level as me, and that wouldn't have been many people because I wasn't particularly highly ranked, but they would say, hi, Sir Troy. How are you, Sir Troy? Good morning, Sir Troy. Which always sounded super weird to me, but that's the cultural thing. It's very hierarchical. And I don't know if Gerard was expecting a Sir Gerard or not when we spoke, but you're not going to get that from an Aussie, mate. Like, that's just not going to happen. And I was very candid with my feelings about the whole situation. And anyway, I ended up doing both. So I ended up like going to the Philippines, doing the meeting. And when I say a meeting, it was like a team thing that went for 3 days or something. And I did like 2 days. And then I had to fly to Auckland, but there's no direct flight. So I had to go to Singapore, and I got delayed, and I got to Auckland late, and I just got there in time to do my talk. And I was just super, super pissed. And when I went back to Pfizer in Sydney, I literally went to HR and I was like, all right, just give me the bloody paperwork. I'm done, gone, sick of this shit, walking out. And it was only then that I saw the redundancy provisions. And that's when I was like, oh, okay. It would be nice if they didn't want me anymore instead of the other way around. Anyway, he didn't really talk to me again after that. It literally went from April 2014 through until January 2015, talking to him like several times, which was fantastic because I didn't really like him. If he's like, is he's not going to talk to me, well, then that's great, because I've been here at the time, what was it, like 13 years. I know my way around. I can keep myself busy. And I was busy. But that was the thing that just absolutely set in my mind I had to get out of there. And the relationship, as it comes back to Niall, is one of the other blog posts that I've got in this book that I'm giving some more background to, is, remember, mate, when I went to my first NDC in Oslo in 2014, and you helped me get into that, and then we did the talk, and we were sitting down at the bottom of the Radisson Blu drinking whiskey, and I was just so upset about my job and the life that I was stuck in. And this was only a couple of months after the Gerard situation. And 1 year later, I was back in Oslo again as a free agent, and suddenly everything kind of turned around. But anyway, so that's sort of all the background stuff that was burbling away that I just couldn't put into writing or didn't seem to be relevant at the time. So I just want to, you know, again, sort of get from people, and I'm going to keep sort of pushing this each week. You know, what are the questions you have about how the hell I ended up here, like living the way I am on a beach, writing about other people stealing data? I'd love to hear what it is that people want to know. So I'm going to focus more on that. I'm just looking at some of the comments in here. Lots of barbecue comments in here. Barbecue always good. One of the other things Niall and I have been doing a lot of in Oslo is going to barbecue. Niall says in the comments, he tried to hire me. Lucky we didn't do that. It is lucky, right? It's I was ready to do just about anything to get out of the place at the time. But it was one of these things, I think it's kind of like a life lesson there for my kids as well, which is I hated the job, but hating it alone is not a good enough reason to walk out on it. There had to be something better. And there's all sorts of reasons why I say that, other things that I'm a bit upset about in life. But sometimes you just got to stick with stuff that you really, really don't enjoy for the greater good. And it's sort of like short-term sacrifice for long-term gain stuff. Rob has a question here. What role did you have at Pfizer? So I went to Pfizer in 2001 as a developer. I was doing classic ASP. Woo, at the time. So I did that for many years. And then, of course, .NET and the whole Microsoft stack. And Pfizer was like many organizations both then and today where they sort of said, look, you're okay as a developer. And I don't think I was sensational, but I was okay. If you would like your career to progress, you need to stop developing and you need to manage people. And I was just like, oh, crap, I don't even like people. Well, I don't like managing people, you know. I don't think this is going to be my strength. So they made me an architect, which I cannot say without air quoting. So architect is just this really vague, amorphous kind of title under which different people do completely different things. At least with a developer, it's like I'm actually writing software. Architect is like, are you drawing UML diagrams every day, or are you an enterprise architect or a business architect, or, you know, whatever the hell term you want to put in front of it. But for Pfizer, what it meant is they had decided that people like myself and possibly those of you watching this as well, developers, were expensive. We could save a lot of money if we got rid of the expensive developers. And what we'll do instead is we will outsource everything. And it will be wonderful. So they got rid of so many contract developers. In fact, I was contract at the point where they started going through this, and I only went permanent later on. So we will start getting rid of them, and we will start outsourcing everything. And there's really, really cheap developers in India, China, and the Philippines. So we will outsource everything to India, China, and the Philippines, and it will be wonderful. Anyway, it wasn't. So my role as architect largely came down to validating the design that was proposed by vendors, having some input into that as well, and then reviewing the shit that used to come back time and time again, the shit that used to come back. I must make sure this features in the book somewhere, some of the examples. I'll give you a good example. I'm spending longer than this of what I planned to, but since Rob asked the question, we had one product built in China, and it was an iPhone application. And they send the app, and I install it on my phone. And because I'm a curious guy and I'm getting interested in the security space, I proxy the phone through Fiddler. So it's very easy to proxy your mobile device through Fiddler. And back at the time, we didn't really have public key pinning or other things like that, which made it harder to go through and actually inspect traffic. So I've proxied the phone through, and I'm looking at the traffic. And one of the services I called was a classic web services implementation where there was a WSDL, remember the old web services definition language, and you could go there and it would describe all of the other services that were running at this endpoint. And there was a service called Get Users. And you wouldn't believe what it did. Like you could then just take that URL, go to your browser, and get all of the users. And every single user would be returned, including the user's plain text password. Now, this would have been probably about 2012, I'd say. And I went, all right, well, this is just like it's not unusual based on the quality of the organizations we're outsourcing to. Incidentally, some of them were some of the largest outsourcing companies that you have heard of, and you would be very likely familiar with a couple of the beginning ones in particular. And I went back to them and I said, look, I proxied my device through Fiddler. I looked at the traffic and now I have all the passwords. And I kid you not, the answer that came back was the company said, that's okay, our users don't use Fiddler. And I knew I needed to make a change in life. You know, like this was literally the level of how I was spending my days. And incidentally, that's what made me start doing a lot more blogging and made me want to build Have I Been Pwned, because I was just going absolutely brain dead dealing with this inane stuff that I wanted to do something to push myself a bit more. So anyway, that's the sort of stuff that's going in there. And there'll be a lot of other things that we do surrounding this as well. It won't just be the book as well. There'll be a lot of other media stuff, but we'll get back to that as time goes by. All right, moving on. Things on my list. Oh, I ordered a DataColor Spider X Pro monitor calibration device, which is a bit wordy. But I posted a photo of my screen setup here because I've still got the big ultra wide in the middle and then the two 27-inch curved jobs on the right. And someone said, oh, you should get one of these, the monitor calibration. Now, when I looked at the photo, it's like, yeah, I can actually see from the photo the color's a little bit different. What I really notice with color is if I'm doing anything in Photoshop, so for example, after I finish this video and I get a still of the video, and then if I drag, in fact, even if I drag the live video at the moment from one monitor to the other, I can see like a color change. So clearly they're not calibrated the same. And I just wanted to get a tool that just made everything consistent, because it did sort of bug me a little bit. And this should fix that and hopefully make everything look very, very nice. So that's one of the toys. It's not a toy, it's a business device, which is what's going on my tax returns. It's a business device in order to help everything hopefully look a little bit nicer. Now, have I been pwned? So I'm going to talk about a few things with Have I Been Pwned and data breaches. In fact, what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring up a list of recent breaches. And actually, while I'm there, I tweeted something since last week. I've had my first ever appearance of Have I Been Pwned on a sign. So we have sponsored the local tennis club. They've just had a big court redevelopment, and that's a big part of Charlotte's and my lives and the kids' lives as well. And they were looking for sponsorship to try and help fund some of the development. So I actually got a Have I Been Pwned sign printed on the back of the court, which is awesome. And it's on court one. So it's like I play on court one and it's like, there's Have I Been Pwned. And then there's a little sign on the gate on the way in, and then another one on the side. And it's just really cool to like see a manifestation of something which is usually only digital actually appear in the physical world. Now, that said, I've had a bunch of data breaches going this week. And I was pretty busy there. I sort of found a day where I had some time, and I published four different breaches in one day, and one or two interesting things have come out of it. So one of these here, I don't know how many Lithuanian people on the live stream at the moment, but there's a Lithuanian car sharing service called CityBee. Now, they got breached. It was only 110,000 records, but I must have had like four or five people all simultaneously pop up and go, hey, have you seen CityBee? Because the data had been published to a popular hacking forum as well. And there were just lots of people simultaneously interested about it. So normally I would have gone, well, 110 is way down the list of size in the backlog of things I already have left to deal with. So I'll sort it out another time. But the interest from so many people, get it loaded. So data included email addresses, government IDs, always a bit of a worry there, and unsalted SHA-1 password hashes. That was a bad idea a decade ago. So to have a modern day, or let's just say a service running in the modern day, still doing that is just kind of crazy. So there's that one. Now another one here, this one actually turned out kind of interesting, NetGalley. So NetGalley had 1.4 million unique email addresses breached in December, names, usernames, physical and IP addresses, phone numbers, dates of birth, and salted SHA-1 password hashes. I did end up having some discussions with people from NetGalley after this, which is, I think, an interesting outcome. Maybe that's something that's going to appear in another book later on as to what those discussions were. But I don't want to make that sound sort of dodgy, because they were cool. But it's always kind of interesting to speak to the people behind the organizations in these breaches. And suddenly things that you just see there on the headline, where often it looks kind of shit. So, for example, Salted SHA-1 password hash is kind of shit. And then you speak to the people behind it and you sort of start to understand not just why, but the impact on them as well. I remember one data breach probably 6 months ago, and I won't say which one it is, but it was a small organization but with quite a large number of records. And I just remember speaking to the founder of this business, and he was like almost in tears going, my life's work is just going to be gone and destroyed. I'm actually not sure what happened to that company. So it has a real impact. So that was that one. Another one here, People's Energy in the UK had 359,000 unique email addresses breached in December. It was about 7 gigabytes worth of data, names, phone number, physical addresses, and dates of birth. Only 24% of them have been pwned, which is a really, really low hit rate, actually. So that's quite interesting to see that quite low. And usually I'll see a really low figure if it's let's say, for argument's sake, a data breach from a Thailand online e-commerce sort of store. So that would be a good example. So I can only assume with People's Energy, maybe there is, say, an older demographic that tends to use this service and they don't have as many accounts and haven't been in as many other data breaches. And this one was a shocker, absolute shocker. Nursery Cam had over 10,000 records exposed this month due to a series of security flaws before the service was shut down. 80% were already never been pwned. But here's the shocker. And I'm just going to sort of pick some bits and pieces from here. So the Register has got a story here. I'll link through to that from my description of the breach. Their title is Nursery Cam Horror Show, Secure Daycare Video Monitoring Product Beamed DVR Admin Creds to All Users. So basically it was the admin creds of the DVR service, which people were actually signing up so they could watch their kids at nursery. Those creds were sent down to every single person using the service. It was just in the background, a little bit like the example I just gave you with Pfizer. Our users don't use Fiddler. But what's just mind-numbingly stupid here is the way the organization has responded to criticism from security researchers, including a mate of Scott's and mine, Cyber Gibbons here from Pentest Partners. And it's things like the Melissa Cow. KAO, Calco, director of Footfall Cam, which makes these, insisted to the Register that what InfoSec researchers had found was legacy non-functional codes. Codes, plural. That's odd. That were there to distract hackers. that's the worst excuse ever. We put this stuff here to distract the hackers. What a crock of shit. So anyway, Cyber Gibbons, he actually did a series of tweets on this about just how terrible it was. He's written up some information here as well. Someone else actually did a write-up too, and in fact there's a separate story here on Footfall Cam, on the Register about Footfall Cam. Firm apologizes, promises fixed product after viral Twitter feed. And I saw this Twitter feed when it happens. There's an account here called Oversoft NL, which I assume is someone from the Netherlands. What does their account say just here? Over 4NL, yes, from the Netherlands. And he's saying, as per usual, I usually do some basic security sanity checks on a product before offering it to our customers. So he powered it on and followed the instructions to set it up. It gets powered over Ethernet, but also has Wi-Fi to count the number of devices passing. And then there's this thread of just absolute horror show that goes on beneath it. So this is really worthwhile having a look at. And the reason I put it in Have I Been Pwned for such a small number of accounts was it was just such a train wreck of a data breach. And it was also one of those cases. So someone did actually reach out and send me the data. And it was one of those cases where it was like, I don't have confidence in reading the way this organization handled it, that they have actually contacted everyone that was impacted by this. So Zen, have I been pwned? If you think that you might have been impacted by the nursery cam data breach, you can actually go and see it now. Now, there's one other, which I can't talk about yet, which is ongoing. I wonder if I've got a message back about this. I get sent a lot of breaches every single day. I get sent, I'd say this year I'm averaging probably three different discrete data breaches a day. And there is one that's been sent to me, which I'm not convinced is being handled in the right way. And it might relate to a part of the world I have already discussed today. And I think by the time I do this next week, this will be in Have I Been Pwned? And it will be a publicly known incident. But it's based on the numbers I've seen already, it will be at least a seven-figure number of records with quite an extensive amount of data associated to it. So that's all I can really say at the moment, because I'm literally sort of trying to push the right buttons in the organization to get them to handle this in the correct way, which is kind of the story of my life. But we'll see. It just shouldn't be this hard. I'll explain why probably next week. Look at some of the comments. Dominic, damn, I miss after work Friday night drinks. Why stop? I was like, okay, it's just going to be you, but, you know, it's just me sitting here. So nursery cam hacker distraction, not a honeypot, more of a lollipop. Oh, that just sounds really bad in all sorts of ways. All right, I'll go on to something else. Let me talk about 3D printer. So I've mentioned before how I get distracted by shiny things really quickly. And when I was doing my big round Australia trip, which ended earlier last month, I ended up in Adelaide. If you're not from Australia and you haven't heard of Adelaide, you're not missing anything. It's kind of like Canberra. Anyway, so I ended up down there with a mate of mine, and he had a 3D printer, had a Prusa 3D printer, and he was printing some really, really epic stuff. And I'm looking at it going, man, this is amazing. Like, I've always thought this would be a little bit of fun, but I've never really given it much thought. And he was like, yeah, look, you know, here's all the features of it, and here's the things we've been creating. And he has a couple of kids a few years younger than mine, and they were actually designing some stuff and printing it too, which I thought, wow, that's really, really cool. So I went, all right, I'm here. You know what you're doing. Like, help me order one of these. So I ordered a Prusa 3D printer. It's a Mark III 3D printer, so it's basically just the current generation of their printer. I ordered the kit so that I had to build the whole thing. And then over a period of a few days, spending probably a few hours a day, I just built it bit by bit by bit, and now I have a printer. And it's been a really, really fun learning curve to build it rather than buy it built. And then there's been a fun learning curve to figure out how to actually use the thing and to figure out what to actually print. And I'm just looking at the things that I have on my desk here at the moment, because I wanted to talk about some of the stuff we've been printing and how it has been just absolutely awesome for the kids as well. Super, super awesome for the kids. So we sort of went, all right, let's start by maybe printing some of the things that come as samples on the SD card. So things like the still that I did for the video has this little frog on it. So I got a little pink frog in my hand. Now, one of the things that's interesting with the pink frog is that it's got these very, very tiny feet at the bottom of it. So there's a particular way it prints these. It puts what you call a brim on it, which is almost like some reinforcement that sits on the base here so that the feet don't break off. So that's in the sample kit. The little boat that I'm holding here tends to be like the canonical 3D print hello world, you know, to try and demonstrate that you can print. And it then prints out in such a way that it highlights particular features of printers. I think I'm learning here. So there's that. And then you can go onto websites like Thingiverse. And Thingiverse is amazing because there's all of these 3D models up there that you can download and then print. So, for example, my son Ari really wanted to print Among Us characters. So, first of all, obvious question, what was Among Us? That was a good place for me to start. Then when I figured out what Among Us was, I think, you go and get the character and you build them in pieces. So this has got, we've printed like the feet, and then it's got a little socket here where you put the guts. You got to put the guts in here. We've still got to print the bone. I need to get some white filament for the bone. That'll go in here. And then the head goes on the top like that. And then we're just waiting to get the visor as well. So I've got to print a visor, which will probably print with a white filament, and then you will have an Among Us character. And like, yeah, you could go and buy these from the shop, but what's fascinating about it is actually seeing the design in 3D. So most of these 3D models are in a .stl format. Loads of different products can create .stl, work with .stl. So you then take this 3D model and you take it into Prusa Slicer, which is the software that says, okay, how do we take a 3D model and convert it into commands that a 3D printer can actually print? So for example, how detailed should we make the print? Should we make it 0.2 millimeter worth of detail or 0.1 millimeter worth of detail? Or do you want to just go faster and do it in like a draft mode? What sort of filament are you going to use? Because that will change possibly the temperature and some of the construction. Do we need to, in the case of Froggy, have a little brim around the feet? Or in the case of some of the other things we've made, do we need to actually add some supports because we're going to print sort of out in an angle and there's got to be something underneath it to hold it up? So you take it in the slicer. Other things we've printed as well. So I printed a vase. This is a vase. Trust me, I know it looks suspicious. This is a vase. And this was really cool too, just sort of seeing it gradually built up layer by layer by layer. And you could now put, you know, a flower in there or some pins or something. And again, I could have gone and bought one much easier, possibly even cheaper if you take my time into consideration as well. But seeing stuff made is amazing. Things like moving parts. So the one I got in my hand here is they are herringbone helical gears. So herringbone being that they're kind of triangular, one gear fits into another, which is why nothing slips out of here. And you can sort of hear it on the microphone. But what's amazing is that this is one printed piece. Like, we didn't put things together. It was just one print, and the tolerances and everything are fine enough that you can actually move this stuff around, which is just absolutely fascinating that you can do that on a printer that I built in my home. Nuts and bolts. Now, this was on Thingiverse as well, and I don't know precisely why I printed it. It just seemed kind of cool. So it's literally a big nut and a bolt that you can do up together. And then we started getting really carried away because I wanted to go, all right, well, this is like, it's fun printing things off the card and it's fun printing things off Thingiverse, but I want the kids to build stuff. Like, you should be designing things. So one of the services they've been using a lot is a website called Tinkercad. Now, Tinkercad is made by Autodesk. It's freely available. You just sign up and get an account. I later learned my son had used it at school as well, which is great. And you can do things like create name tags like this. So my daughter made this one for Charlotte, and it's a little thing that she can sit on her desk. It's got a flat base like that. You sit it on the desk, and that's great. And it's simple, right? But she had to go into Tinkercad, create a 3D diagram or a 3D model, do the lettering, decide the depth of the lettering, and then we're going, well, look, if we print this, all the letters are going to fall apart. So let's put like an underline on it. So this is going to be another cube. And in order to create this cube, you're going to need to understand that cubes have three dimensions, and you're going to need to use the mouse to rotate the thing around, see how thick it's going to look. Is it going to make sense? And then we can print it, and you can see something that you've created digitally come to life. And that has just been an amazingly cool and fulfilling experience. So the kids have made name tags for their bags, and they're the most basic name tags you can imagine, but they made these things, and now they hang off their school bags. The other one, which we just started doing yesterday, and this is really good fun, we got a little while ago some caricatures made up. So there's a mate of ours from NDC, a guy called David Neal, and David is famous at NDC conferences for sitting there like drawing diagrams of the talk that people give. And he also does caricatures on commission. So we all got caricatures made. And what you can do now is you can take the caricature and you can go to, I'm going to tell you what the name of this service is. I think it is like PNG to STL or something like that. It is image2stl.com. You go to image2stl.com, you put your image in there, and it creates a 3D. It is 3D. It's a 3D model because it does actually have depth to it. But long and short of it, they print out and they look like this. So this is Al and Charlotte in a 3D model that is printed, and then you can sort of sit on the desk or something. And it actually looks super, super cool. Like, I'm geeking out on it, right? Like, I find it amazing that you can take an image and then turn it into like a block of plastic that actually looks like someone. So this was a very basic one. We're playing around with what are the right settings for this, but I think what we'll do, I actually tweeted this earlier on, and I put a photo under that of a bigger one that was printing just of L, but we'll sort of get some larger ones printed up. I think this is actually too thick, and I think it's better just having one person one, doing them in different color filaments and then putting them on the wall, and it creates like a little montage of the family, which is really, really cool. Oh, yeah, I'm just going to look at some of the comments that are coming through here. What else is in here? Are you seeing a trend of people using unique passwords yet, or is it a credential stuffing still a problem? Yeah, it's still a massive problem. Even today, there's some stuff I'm doing with the law enforcement agency, which is related to the fact that they just keep seeing loads and loads of credential stuffing. And it is nonstop because we've still got humans, right? Like, humans are still there creating passwords, doing the same stupid thing they've always done. I had a Facebook friend, someone I know casually through the tennis club, put a message on a few days ago, and he's like, in case anyone gets a WhatsApp message from me, it's not me, just so you know, because my WhatsApp has been hacked. And I'm thinking, no, it hasn't been hacked. You're using the same stupid password everywhere. So just to mess with him, I just replied to the Facebook comment. It's like, how do we know this is the real you? So maybe this is the hacker, and your WhatsApp is actually okay, but the hacker is in your Facebook, and they're trying to get people off your WhatsApp to go anyway. So yeah, it's still a massive, massive problem, and there is no end in sight to it because there are no password alternatives in sight that are going to have any meaningful impact. Lance, so weird listening to Troy at 1X. Long time since I've seen him in person. It has been, hasn't it, mate? But this might start to change. We'll start to get at least that domestic travel back very shortly. Niall says, for the book, dealing the stress of the breach, a lot of these breaches can run of the mill data exposures, but you also have those horrible or sensitive ones. So one of the blog posts that's gone into this book is the one about Ashley Madison, where people started sending me messages about the impact of the breach on them. And the blog's titled, Here's What Ashley Madison Members Have Told Me. And that one was really, really hard because, if you recall, Ashley Madison had more than 30 million people involved in the breach. It is a breach where multiple people killed themselves as a result of this because the breach literally ruined their lives. And regardless of your views on the whole adultery thing, so if you recall, Ashley Madison's entire reason of existence was life is short, have an affair. That was literally their motto. Regardless of how you feel about that whole premise, like people died, and that's just a really, really tragic thing. There are also many people that were not having affairs, either because they were single, so there were people who were single using Ashley Madison. Maybe they were trying to find someone else to have an affair, and you got a different issue with that. There were people who in several cases there were women who said, I was worried that my husband was having an affair and I'd seen Ashley Madison on the computer or something, so I created an account on there to catch him, caught him, relationship broke down, tragic, very, very difficult to deal with. I got over it. I moved on. I'm in a new relationship, but my data is still in Ashley Madison. And now this has just happened and it looks like I'm an adulteress because my account was in there. So there are all these really, really interesting stories. And I was getting messages from people in some cases along the lines of, in fact, one quite literally said something to the effect of, kiss your kids goodnight tonight. I'm not sure how long I'm still going to be able to see mine for. And it's like, I am ill-equipped to deal with this. This is really, really full on. So, yeah, that one is in the book, and there's some other observations around what happened there. There are others which aren't necessarily in the book. There's a bunch that I never end up writing blog posts about. Some really, really, really edgy ones in there that maybe there needs to be like an adults-only version of this podcast one time and I can talk about those. But, so some of that will be in there, mate. Upload the download says, I haven't been able to print any in-place gears, etc. kind of prints with my Ender 3. I have a sneaking suspicion my calibration is off. I know Scott Helm has an Ender. I don't know if it's an Ender 3 or not. The Prusa seems like you do pay a bit of a premium for it. But what I consistently hear from people is that it just consistently works really, really well. And mine has been great. I never had a problem with doing the gear stuff. I've got one problem with my Prusa, which is the filament sensor seems to have a problem. So it has what is, I know exactly how this works now because I built the bloody thing, but it has, when you pass the filament in, it pushes a little lever aside, and the lever then sits in between a little laser in a board so that it can then sense that there's a filament in there because it's pushed the little lever aside, and that's then plugged into the logic board, which should then be able to tell the computer that someone has just put filament in there so it can now auto-load. Now, for some reason, that's not working. It looks to me like the mechanical bits are right, like the lever goes aside, it sits in the middle of the laser off the circuit board, so maybe it's something electronic. So I've got to troubleshoot that. But fortunately, you can just disable auto load and just manually load, which is what I've been doing. But where was I going with that? It has been super, super reliable. I did the calibration once. I was pretty freaking amazed that it worked and didn't catch fire the first time I ran it, to be honest, because I had built it and I don't know what I'm doing beyond the instructions. But yeah, maybe that's a calibration thing. Joshua says, Prusa's law, the number of useless 3D print objects on your desk doubles every paycheck. The thing is that, like, I got a bunch of filament and I cannot print fast enough to use anywhere near the amount of filament I have with any reasonable time frame. So I think that's actually going to take quite a while. One of the things that has totally reset my expectation is when I ordered it, I thought, I've got a walk-in robe closet here in my office that's large enough that there should be sufficient airflow and all the rest of it. And there's a bench in there on top of some drawers. I'll put it in there. And what I realized really early on is that everybody wants to watch the printer. So the day I got it working, we had a little bit of a neighborhood party with a bunch of people over, and I was like, I'm going to leave this right in the coffee table in the middle of the lounge room because everyone's going to want to watch it. And they did. So my plan now is I'm going to actually put it between the kids' room. There's a bit of space there we don't know what to do with, and probably turn that into a big workbench with the printer and some stools, and they can do the 3D printing and other things as well. But to have it somewhere central because people love looking at it, and then there'll be lots of shelves we can put all the 3D printed things as well. But it is something which has really gotten the kids and obviously myself quite enthusiastic at the moment. Comment here, you should search on how to print pictures as lithophane. Now, several people have mentioned this today, and I've got to be honest, I don't know exactly what that is, but I do know how to Google. So these are, oh, wow, these are cool. There's an image to lithophane generator. That looks cool. And what does that look like when it comes out? Oh, they look really cool. Yeah. All right. That might be the next thing. All right. There goes my weekend. Thanks for that, mate. But this is kind of the thing, right? Because you just continually find new uses for the printer, which is cool. Dominic, will there be guitar lessons in the book? So here's a fun story. At the moment, I do not plan to put the blog post about guitar lessons in the book. So this was the blog post about people getting upset on social media because I wasn't talking about the things that they wanted me to talk about, and I eventually just lost my patience with the whole thing, and I put a whole bunch of examples in the blog post and went to town on people. Now, I'm going to talk, in fact, this is one of the things we flagged. I'm going to be doing an interview on this separately, explaining why later on. So I'm not going to blow the secret on that now. But as it stands at the moment, that blog post won't be in the book. But stay tuned to find out why. Is anyone else getting a slight distortion on the mic? Not me. It's fine. Rob says, oh, okay, a few people, a little bit here too. Well, okay. All right, crap. I can open my Ubiquiti control panel and I can see how much data's are going up and down the wire. And I can also have a look and see if it is my machine here, because one of the joys that we have in Australia is we do have absolutely crappy bandwidth all over the place. And it seems that of my upload bytes, it's Chrome that is using all of the bytes. But I don't think I'm anywhere near the I don't think I'm anywhere near capacity. So I'm just going to power on, and hopefully it's not too terrible for people, but I'm going to listen back to this later on. Where are we? 45 minutes. Okay, so what does Ubiquiti say? Real-time usage upload is about 3.5 megabits per second of 26 megabits. Isn't it nice having good network gear? All right, so it's not my internet connection, put it that way. Well, at least I'm only using a fraction of what I normally have available. So, yeah. All right. I haven't touched anything, so I can't untouch anything. I'm going to power on. So, IoT. Now, I put in the tweet before I did this that I'm going to talk about IoT, and within the IoT, I'm going to talk about the beer fridge speaking Norwegian. So, one of the things that I've been trying to do is like pick what are good practical use cases for IoT which make life better in one way or another. And one of the things that dawned on me the other day, in fact, we were walking out of the house and I could hear this beeping. I could hear this beeping in the garage, and the fridge door hadn't been shut properly. And it's now, to be honest, a pretty old fridge. If you don't close the door properly, it just doesn't close. You can't just sort of swing it and walk away. So fridge door hadn't been shut properly. And I was like, wow, I wonder if I could IoT this. So I put one of the Zigbee temperature sensors in the fridge. Now, someone said in one of the tweets, they're like, isn't a fridge basically a Faraday cage? Well, apparently not. So I've actually had really reliable connectivity between the Zigbee Akera temperature sensor in the fridge, and it's probably talking directly to the Conbi, which is stuck in the Raspberry Pi inside my server cabinet. So now I get to see this temperature cycle of the fridge. And I've actually learned something really, really interesting. Now, I didn't know this because I haven't given a lot of thought to the way fridges work, but the temperature is not consistent in a fridge. So, and I've noticed this because we actually bought a very new wine fridge recently with a top bit and a bottom bit. So I put one sensor in each one of those. And then I put the sensor in the beer fridge as well. And what happens with these fridges, particularly when they're colder, so the beer fridge is sitting at the moment at 2.5 degrees, the wine fridge is about 7. It's a constant oscillation of temperature. So I'm seeing a temperature oscillation in the beer fridge that goes between 2.2 degrees, let's say at 36 past the hour, up to 3.6 degrees half an hour later. And then it comes down and then it goes up. So we're oscillating, what's that? By about a degree and a bit every hour on a really regular cycle. Now, that's really pretty inconsequential, but it's just like, here is one of the things that I have learned once I start to measure things, which is actually super interesting. So what I can do now is I can say, well, what happens if that temperature goes up too high? So I put a threshold on. I said, if the temperature gets to 5 degrees, make the Sonos talk, send an alert to my watch and send an alert to Charlotte's watch as well. In fact, it sends an alert to the phone, but when you have the watch on, it'll pop on there too. And that is fantastic because now as soon as it happens, I can get an alert. And then I realize that there is actually an alert integration in Home Assistant where you can keep sending the alert until you actually fix the underlying state. So that's the next thing I've got to do. But the fun bit was I'm using the Nabucasa cloud-based text-to-speech feature. So I just rolled over to that recently. And you can choose the voice. So it's the usual kind of, would you like the female or the male American voice or the female or the male Australian voice? And then I found one which was the Norwegian voice. And I thought, this is going to be really, really funny because Charlotte's Norwegian. She's homesick because she can't go home. I'll use the Norwegian voice. Now, she tells me it sounds, I was going to use a word there which wasn't really appropriate. Sounds not right. And I did a little video clip and I put it in a tweet the other day. But to me, it sounds absolutely hilarious. Now, I'm sure most people can't understand it. I can't understand the numbers. I think she tries to say the numbers in Norwegian. But if you get it to say the actual words, it sounds super, super funny. And without getting myself into trouble by talking about which accents sound funny, you can go through and choose all sorts of different languages. And it says it like with the accent that you expect it to use, which is really, really childish and fun. Let's put it that way. So this is what I've learned this week. Now, along with this, I mentioned in last week's update, I've got a whole bunch of Shelleys behind switches now, so a lot more of the house is now actually automated. The kids' lights are turning off without them having to touch it, which is great because they don't touch them, and the kids' fans and bathrooms and closets and things. I've got one Shelley that wasn't wired up properly, so I cannot manually change the light in my guest toilet at the moment, so that's something I've got to get the electrician back to fix. But for the most part, it's actually all working really well. So next things on my to-do list, I really want to do some slick-looking dashboards. I need to get up to speed with InfluxDB and Grafana, I think is going to be my next task, and then get all of this mounted on a panel that I can put near the kitchen or something like that too. So I'll find an old iPad laying around the place and do that. So that's where that is. Now, Robin, g'day, Robin, and another one from the other side of the world. I've got an Akera door sensor on my freezer thanks to your influence, Troy. All right, awesome. So those Akera devices, and just as an example, this is an Akera motion sensor. They're Zigbee-based, so Zigbee is low power usage, low bandwidth as well, which is fine because you don't need to use much bandwidth with these. And they're all in Aussie dollars, 25-ish dollars. So I have admittedly bought quite a lot of them, but as a single unit, that's not a whole lot. And they can all join a Zigbee mesh network as well. So if you have powered Zigbee devices that connect as repeaters, like I do on my desk there and there and there, because I've got Philips Hue lights, which are on the Zigbee network, so they all act as repeaters, then you just create this big Zigbee mesh network and you get lots of coverage. So they're perfect for doing this sort of thing. Comment here, it says, the fridge temp oscillation is because of the way they made it more economic. By sampling temps at a lower state, it will turn on or off fewer times. Side effect is you get oscillations, which is fine for like beer and stuff. I'm not going to do this, but hypothetically, I'm sure if you were to measure the temp of the beer in the can, it would not oscillate as much as the temperature in the freezer itself. Same kind of oscillations you will see on a printer heated bed if you ever mess with firmware and you have to calibrate the PID for the bed. Oh, very interesting point here. Joshua Nyland says, check out Unify Polar. This project will ingest all Unify stats in InfluxDB and provide great dashboards in Grafana to display the information. Now, I'm pretty sure Scott's done that because he was showing me some of his dashboards a while ago. And I was like, wow, this is really, really cool. I could blow more time, even more time doing this. Incidentally, I'm meant to be doing like two chapters of this book every single day, and I haven't been doing a great job of actually doing two chapters every day. But yeah, hey, something shiny. Thanks, Joshua. I can see where my weekend's going now. So look, that's about it from here. Again, on the book bit, which I mentioned earlier on, I'm really curious about what it is that people would like to know. And I'll start to tweet more about this later on as well. This won't be a traditional book by any sense of the imagination, either in the content or the way we release it either. This is going to be quite different. And as time goes by, I'll share a lot more about that, as well as the other party who's involved in it as well, which many of you will know. So thank you very much for joining into that. I'm going to go and tune out and enjoy my Friday evening, and I don't know, maybe I'll go print some more stuff. I'm printing another one of the octopi, in case anyone's ever seen those before. They're very much like these in that they've got moving parts, but all the legs dangle. And I printed one at 0.2 millimeters of precision the other day, and it broke. So it's printing one at 0.1 millimeters of precision. I know, it's exciting, right? All right, enjoy your weekend, folks. I shall see you next week.